Hi, podcast listeners. Lost in the Stacks broadcasts on WREK Atlanta from the campus of Georgia Tech every Friday at noon. Thanks for joining us through the internet, and if you have a moment, let us know how you found us, how you're listening, and what you like. We're always trying to improve and expand. Enjoy the show.
Baby, listen to this fascist gas bag.
Freedom and freedom have always existed in a very precarious balance, and when buildings start blowing up, people's priorities tend to change.
He's got a point there, sweetie.
Bobby.
I mean, who is this idiot?
He is talking about ending personal privacy. Do you want your phone tapped?
I'm not planning on blowing up the country.
Well, how do we know until we've heard all your dirty little secrets?
You're just gonna have to trust me.
Oh, I know. We'll just tap the criminals. We won't suspend the civil rights of the good people.
Right.
Then who decides which is which?
I think you should.
You know, Bobby, I think you should take this more seriously.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the one and only research library rock and roll radio show. I am Charlie. My co-host is Amit.
Hey, everyone.
And we both work at the Georgia Tech Library. Anthony is on the board. Once a year, we're going to hear that.
I'm looking forward to it. Well, actually, might not be here next year.
Oh, man.
So it's going to, you guys will hear it. I won't hear it.
This became such a bummer so quickly. Okay, now I'm better. Alex, Jason, and Fred are in the studio with us, and for the next hour, we've got music and library talk for you. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Our show today is called The Library Freedom Project.
Those are all very good, important words and an article.
We reached out to the founder and director of the Library Freedom Project to learn about the work of the organization.
And our songs today are all about networks and relays, staying anonymous, and being watched. Libraries stand for privacy, guarding against intrusions. And when those intrusions come from our own government, that kind of attention is uncomfortable and unwelcome.
That's a very diplomatic way of saying that.
Uncomfortable and unwelcome. Good sir. Let's start with a song about unwelcome attention. This is Sheila Na Gig by PJ Harvey, right
yeah!
there on Lost in the Stacks. Yes!
I've been trying to show you over and over. Look at these, my childbearing hips. Look at these, my ruby red, ruby lips. Look at these, my work strong arms and...
Welcome to Lost in the Stacks, and joining us by phone, en route, on a train, is Allison Macrina. She's the founder and director of the Library Freedom Project. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, this is how presidential candidates are interviewed, usually en route, in a train, or on a plane.
Yeah, I kind of have a similar route, like, I'm not exactly campaigning, but I am always on tour.
So nice.
I'll try to be as presidential as possible.
Yeah, excellent. Well, tell us a little bit about the Library Freedom Project. What is it? How did it get started?
Sure. So Library Freedom Project is an initiative that aims to make real the promise of intellectual freedom in libraries. And we do that by teaching librarians and their local communities about privacy, some of the threats to privacy, things that we've learned about surveillance after Snowden and from other whistleblowers, what their rights are, what responsibilities librarians have to protect the privacy of their patrons, and what kind of technology they can use either on library computers or in the kind of computer classes that many libraries already offer that will help subvert some of the more egregious types of surveillance that we've seen and help people to take back some of their digital privacy. And we got started, I started Library Freedom Project a little bit after the first Snowden revelation started coming out in the summer of 2013, because I cared about privacy a lot before that. You know, librarians have a really great history of activism around these issues. We've fought against the USA Patriot Act. We have been really vocal about against Bush's warrantless wiretapping program. We were some of the first people to challenge the receipt of national security letters. But, you know, what was different after the Snowden stuff, I think I realized that the scale of the problem was much bigger than I had anticipated, and that many other people, I think, had anticipated, and that our worst fears about unlawful, overbroad authorization Patriot Act, our worst fears about those had come true. So I started thinking about what we could do in libraries to fight back against this, and how we could help our local communities to make themselves feel safe and to understand why this is such a problem.
And you mentioned the revelations, the Edward Snowden, you know, NSA revelations were one of the motivators for you personally. Did you take courses about privacy or intellectual freedom in library school?
I went for library school, and we did have an ethics class there that covered intellectual freedom and privacy a lot. I'm no longer working in a library now. Obviously, I run Library Freedom Project full-time, but I have worked in libraries for almost a decade, and I would say that those values have been really paramount in everything that we do. But I think if I have any one criticism of our profession and the way we've handled those, is that our interest in them is a little bit more theoretical, I think. You know, we believe very strongly in these ethical commitments, but as far as our practical application of them, I think that we've left some things to be desired. And that's why we made the mission of Library Freedom Project to make real the promise, because we have this great sort of foundation of values, you know, the ALA Library Users Bill of Rights, the ALA Code of Ethics, the ALA Core Values, the ALA Freedom to Read Statement. All of these things make privacy really paramount, and the connection between intellectual freedom and privacy, which to me is that if you don't have privacy, you really can't have intellectual freedom. If you feel like you're being watched, you won't read, write, and research freely. So we've done a great job at sort of outlining all this stuff and what it means to us and what it means to the existence of libraries, but I think we can do more in practical, meaningful ways to protect ourselves and our local communities. So that's what Library Freedom Project is all about.
Allison, can you give an example or two of a practical application? Like, what goes wrong if libraries aren't worried about this and don't put this into practice?
Well, I think, you know, generally speaking, if we as a society decide that we don't care about our privacy, then we've decided to give up on democracy, essentially. I mean, it's so important to many of our other rights. You know, I talk about it in the relationship it has to intellectual freedom, but intellectual freedom is really just one application of the First Amendment. You know, we also have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy. So, and privacy is related to many other rights of ours, you know, both in the Constitution and the things that are kind of more universal, like the Declaration of Human Rights. But specifically, if libraries stop caring about this or libraries don't do anything, I think that surveillance to me poses an existential threat to who we are. You know, if our biggest value is intellectual freedom and we no longer can protect that and offer it to our communities, then we're sort of doomed in our mission. The other side of it is that in libraries, we serve members of communities who are presently and historically have been under more surveillance. You know, marginalized people, vulnerable populations, more specifically, Muslim Americans are under a huge amount of surveillance ever since September 11th and since the Patriot Act. Black Americans are surveilled much more than the total population. People who are in any way engaged in political activism, anybody who is an ethnic or religious minority, and anybody who is any combination of those things, also people who are queer and trans. So these are the people who make up our local communities, and I think that libraries have a really service-minded attitude about our relationship to those communities, and so we should want to help them with the things that are most meaningful in their lives. So it's sort of twofold, you know. One, that it means so much to the very existence of libraries and our commitment to intellectual freedom, and two, that our communities that we serve the most are also the most affected by these issues.
That's very inspiring from Allison Macrina. That's, I think, very well put. You are sounding like a candidate more and more just listening to you. But I think, you know, you're preaching to the choir on this. And libraries have always been the place for privacy to be protected, and seems to be we're at a two roads are diverging here. And which road are we going to take? So. Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Allison Macrina. She's the founder and director of the Library Freedom Project, and we'll be back with more about Allison's work after a music set.
File this set under QA76.9.A25.
Keep It Hid by Dan Auerbach. Before that, Laundrette by Vivian Goldman. Those are songs about anonymous interactions.
Today's Lost in the Stacks is the Library Freedom Project, and we're speaking with Allison Macrina about the work of her organization. So, Allison, in the last segment, you talked quite eloquently about privacy as a core value for libraries, and how, unfortunately, a lot of librarians and library schools think of this as a given or as a purely theoretical idea. But you all are doing something really practical here, and it's the Library Digital Privacy Pledge of 2015. Can you talk a little bit about the pledge?
Sure. So the Library Digital Privacy Pledge is just one of a few of the initiatives that we have going on at Library Freedom Project. Basically, it's an effort that's come out of a lot of discussions and work on the LIDA Patron Privacy Group, and with some members of the Intellectual Freedom Committee, and myself, and with Eric Hellman, who is he runs the Free eBook Foundation. And another organization called Blue Jar. Sorry, Amtrak is talking over me right now. Many apologies. So it's adding to my presidential hair. So the pledge is essentially something that we came up with all together. We see a great need for libraries to use strong encryption on.
You still there, Allison?
I guess
she started talking about encryption, and
somebody didn't like what she had to say.
Allison, well, folks, it looks like we may have lost Allison, so we're gonna call her back and find out what happened.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you okay?
Yeah, I lost you guys.
You know, you just started talking. Around. You talked about encryption. You started talking about encryption, and then you went blank. You went dark.
I know.
And we were really worried about what was going on.
The feds. Yeah. It's always them.
Somebody did not like what you had to say.
No, it's totally... They never do. I'll start over so that we can make it easier. So the Library Digital Privacy Pledge is an initiative, one of many things that Library Freedom Project is working on, to sort of give libraries a practical way to protect their patron privacy. Essentially what it is, it's an effort where we're trying to get libraries, membership organizations, and vendors to agree to use encryption on their services by a certain date, so 6 months after they signed the pledge. And the kind of encryption we're asking them to use is HTTPS transport layer security, which is it's the industry standard for web encryption. Basically, what it means is that anyone who is typing something into the library's website, if they're searching for a book in the catalog or if they're using a library database, they will be protected from interception or observation on the open Wi-Fi. It means that if they look for books about divorce or diabetes or queer and trans issues or anything like that, that somebody observing the network traffic won't be able to see what they're looking at. So we're partnering with, this is a Library Freedom Project initiative. It's me and Eric Hellman, who runs the Free eBook Foundation and Gloojar, and does a lot of blogging and writes a lot about library technology-related stuff. And we're timing the release of this pledge with an initiative called Let's Encrypt, which is something from Electronic Frontier Foundation, Mozilla, and a few other organizations. It's basically going to make it a lot easier for anybody who runs a website to use strong encryption on their site. It's a free, open, and automated certificate authority. So while we're not expecting that our pledge signers are definitely going to use Let's Encrypt, we have, you know, we think it'll encourage a little bit more participation if there's an easy way that folks can join in on something like this. Also, we have some other efforts to make it easier for libraries that want to participate that maybe don't have the technology capabilities in-house. So we've got some great volunteer technologists who will offer their assistance to our participating libraries. We have a lot of resources to help out, and so we're basically trying to make it as simple as possible. So any libraries that want to join us, all they have to do is agree to sign the pledge. We've got a whole FAQ about, you know, everything that they might want to know about how this will affect their website, what it'll do for them. And we haven't officially launched yet, but we've been soliciting participation from some of our library friends and vendors that we know, and we've had a really overwhelmingly positive response. So I think we're going to get a lot of great people signed on to this.
And this is just one, like you mentioned, this is just one of many kind of, you know, you guys are out on the street making it happen. So you're doing classes, workshops. You're doing something called the Tor Exit Relays in Libraries. Can you talk a little bit about what that is? That's Tor, T-O-R, Exit Relays.
Right. So Tor is the anonymity network. Most people who use Tor use it with something called the Tor browser. Tor browser is a web browser that works similarly to any other web browser that you're used to using, like Firefox or Chrome. But what's really special about it is that it offers users anonymity and freedom from certain kinds of censorship. Essentially, what happens when you use Tor browser is that some of your personally identifiable information is not discoverable to the internet, to your ISP, to an intelligence agency that might be observing you, to some of the information is hidden from other, you know, users of the web. Some of it is hidden from the website owners. You know, there's sort of different layers of privacy depending on what you're doing. So Tor is a really great tool. Tor browser is a great tool for privacy and intellectual freedom on the web. It's really the best web browser for privacy, and it's the only one that out of the box offers users a great deal of privacy and security. And the way that Tor works, one of the ways that it works is it takes your traffic and bounces it across a network of relays. These relays are just computers, and the computers, all they do is forward traffic all day. And this means that, you know, that your traffic bounces over the relays, and then when it exits out of the third relay, that the IP address of that relay is the one that is associated with your activity. So it sort of looks like you're a different person. And the Exit Relays in Libraries project is a way for libraries to support the infrastructure of Tor, this really essential privacy technology. Some of the best privacy software that exists, truly. The relays are necessary for the network to run, and libraries, we think, are the best places for them to operate because we can donate some of our unused bandwidth. It won't have any effect on our patrons. It won't change the traffic that they're sending out. It won't change the web that they see. And it's a great practical way for libraries to protect patron privacy, not just in their local communities, but users all over the world, because anybody who connects to Tor will benefit from more relays. It'll make the network stronger. It'll make the network faster. And, you know, we think it fits very well into the kind of work that libraries are already doing.
Great. Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Allison Macrina, founder and director of the Library Freedom Project. She's on a train, and we're going to talk more with Allison on the left
freedom
side of
train.
The hour. The Freedom Train. That's right.
All right. This is Mike Diarlo, the architect. My job is APIs, AIPs, and IPAs. You are listening to Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta.
Today's show is called The Library Freedom Project. As defined in Article 12 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, quote, "No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his or her privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon their honor and reputation." I like that part. "Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks." Privacy is not just personal. It is universal. File this set under TK7882.E2L965.
And that was All the Rowboats by Regina Spektor. That is a song about being closely watched.
Welcome back to Lost in the Stacks. Today on the show, we're talking about freedom, privacy, with Allison Macrina, founder and director of the Library Freedom Project. Allison, in the last segment, we kind of got down in the weeds. I think some of the Georgia Tech students here are really going to dig this conversation about Tor exit relays, because I imagine they're probably running some of that on their own machines. Can you talk a little bit about how Tor has been used in any libraries around the country? I'm assuming this is something that a few libraries at least have already bought into.
Well, one of the things that we teach in our privacy trainings is using and installing Tor browser on library computers and teaching it to patrons in computer classes, because that's the user-facing side of Tor. That's the thing that most people need to know how to use. And I don't know how many libraries have installed it on their computers or taught it to their patrons, but, I mean, it is something that we teach in every one of our trainings, and those are very popular, so I think we've had a pretty good adoption from that. But the Relay Project, we actually just completed our pilot, which was at a library in Lebanon, New Hampshire. We got that relay started in the summer, and we recently turned it into an exit. You know, it was a non-exit relay. There are three in the circuit when your traffic gets pushed along. And so we tested it out as a non-exit and wanted to make sure everything went smoothly, and then turned it into an exit recently. In the middle there, we had some pushback. But all was resolved very well.
You mentioned pushback. So what kind of pushback did you get? What kind of response did you get from the community about this? I guess positive and negative.
So the community was actually was really strongly in favor of it. What happened in the summer when we set the relay pilot up, we got a lot of publicity. Ars Technica wrote about it, and Motherboard, and International Business Times, and a few other places. And, you know, all pretty overwhelmingly positive interest in the project. A few weeks after that, we heard from the library, who said that they had been contacted by their local police, who had in turn been contacted by the Boston field office of the Department of Homeland Security. And the police and the Homeland Security agent had encouraged the library not to participate in the project. So the library suspended the relay. And what we did at Library Freedom Project was we mobilized some really massive support for the library to try to get them to turn the relay back on. We got our friends at Electronic Frontier Foundation set up a petition for us. We got about 4,500 signatures in just a few days. We had Julia Angwin at ProPublica write a really great piece about what had happened, and then there was just a media storm. It was picked up by a few dozen different media entities. And most importantly, we were preparing for the library's board to meet a few days after that because we wanted to make a case for them to bring the relay back online. So most importantly, we got some really incredible local community support. We went to the board meeting, and there were several dozen people there, all in support of keeping the relay up and rejecting the fear-mongering of the DHS and police. And what this did, truly, I mean, it was probably the best thing that could have happened to us, because not only did the board decide to keep the relay back, to keep the relay online, and they didn't even need to vote a second time because they had voted unanimously of it, in favor of it the first time. But the local community really got to come out and express their pride and support for the library and their excitement on this project. And it made for so much wonderful media attention that many other libraries now have asked if they can join the project when we're ready to accept one. So we basically humiliated the Department of Homeland Security, and rightly so. I mean, they had absolutely no business interfering with the autonomy and sovereignty of this library, and they had no course to fear-monger about Tor in the first place. I mean, it was truly a kind of a preemptive strike against this software that helps people all over the world with their privacy and security. So that is all said and done now, and the relay is back up, and we have just turned it into an exit, and we're about to declare the pilot a success, and then we're looking forward to moving on to other libraries who want to participate.
We just have a few minutes left, Allison, but I do want to ask this question. Privacy advocates are often portrayed as naive by, essentially those in power, those in government, who suggest that in order to defend against the threats of the 21st century and that they need access and that essentially it's a trust us, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about mentality. How do you react to those types of suggestions that you know, the work of privacy advocates is just simply naive?
Well, a couple things. The first thing that I want to say is something that Snowden said, which is that saying privacy because they have nothing to hide is like saying that people shouldn't care about their freedom of speech because they have nothing to say. I also think that if the government thinks that we're naive for caring about our privacy, I actually think that they're quite vicious for setting up this like false dichotomy of like, either you give the government all access or you're a criminal. We have a constitution for a reason to prevent that kind of government tyranny. I also think that we have many examples of how people need privacy and have a right to it and are not doing anything wrong. Domestic violence survivors need a great deal of privacy from people who want to abuse them. Political activists need privacy so that they can mobilize and organize without fear of local police or government reprisal. There are myriad examples. Journalists need privacy to help protect their sources. I think that what we have right now is a government, too, that operates under extreme secrecy. And what the Obama administration likes to call itself the most transparent organization or administration that's ever existed, and that's absolutely not true. They operate under a lot of secrecy, especially when it comes to things that are sort of national security matters. If you call it national security, then you don't have to tell anybody about it, and you can say, "Oh, we can't tell you because it's a national security concern, and so we're not going to be very revealing." So they actually believe in extreme privacy and secrecy for themselves, but not for ordinary citizens. The other thing is that there is no good relationship between surveillance and preventing criminal activity, particularly not terrorism. When Keith Alexander was asked about this after the Snowden revelations, he was asked point blank by Congress, how many terrorist attacks have been stopped by surveillance? And the first thing he said was something like 54. And they said, okay, well, General Alexander, that's a big number. Can you tell us some more about these 54 attacks that have been stopped? And of course, he was lying. The number dropped to like 30-something, and then it dropped again, and then it dropped again. And what he eventually landed on was one. He could think of one time when surveillance had prevented what was, as far as he was concerned, a terrorist attack. By the way, I didn't mention Keith Alexander is a former director of the NSA. I said his name, and I didn't say who it was. So this one attack that he could think of that was prevented, what it actually was a cab driver in Los Angeles who had been caught sending money that was allegedly going to al-Shabaab in Somalia. So material support for terrorism. But it was alleged. We don't have any good evidence that this is actually true. I live in the city where there was the most recent domestic terrorist attack. That was, of course, at the Boston Marathon bombing. And that, I think, is a really tragic example that gives lie to the relationship, the alleged relationship between surveillance and fighting terrorism, because Tamerlan Tsarnaev was under a huge amount of surveillance for years by the FBI, the local police, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and that didn't stop him from doing what he did in Boston. So I actually think that surveillance in some ways makes us less safe. And even if it did have a positive relationship to fighting terrorism, it's still wrong. It's still unconstitutional. We have a right to privacy. We choose to close our curtains and open them when we want to. Sometimes we want more privacy, sometimes we want less privacy, but the choice should be our own to make.
Well, thanks so much, Allison, and we appreciate you navigating this difficult terrain with us while actually physically navigating the terrain of the Northeast on an Amtrak train. This has been our first train interview, and I think it was a pretty interesting success.
We don't often talk to people.
My first one, too. So.
We don't often talk to people that can say they humiliated the DHS.
That's right.
I want to put it on my resume. I'm so proud of it. I think I might.
Thanks again, Allison. We've enjoyed speaking with you. And if you're interested in learning more about the Library Freedom Project, it's libraryfreedomproject.org. Allison, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
File this set under C55.408 / T73.
I like that a lot. That was Triangulation Station by Islet, which I desperately want to pronounce as Islet. That was a song about networks and signals.
Charlie, what is going on at the library next week?
You will connect with each other, with yourself, with your work, and we, the library staff and faculty, will support you. Also, on the third floor of Clough Commons, a beautifully curated collection of the technologies of the 20th century on display. And I'd like to point out that that's the past. I leave it to you, dear listener, to explore and discover. Third floor, Clough Commons, Exhibit Gallery. We are the Georgia Tech Library, and we are at your nostalgic service.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library, produced by Amy Doshi, Charlie Bennett, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Rasko.
And you know, I think our former producer, Lizzie Rolando, would have really liked today's show.
Hi, Lizzie. Anthony was our engineer today, and our show was brought to you by LITA, Laser-Induced Thermal Acoustics.
Legal counsel and a hammer to tear up your floorboards were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Allison for joining us en route, to all the whistleblowers out there, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
You can hear this show again or get in touch with us at wrek.org/lostinthestacks. And you can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or at lostinthestacks.libsyn.com.
Changing things up. Next week on Lost in the Stacks, it's the story of the stuff. We're talking about archiving the ephemera of grief.
It's time for our last song today, and a reminder that the Library Freedom Project is, well, it's, hang on, wait.
What?
Someone in a dark suit and sunglasses just walked into the studio.
I don't know who that is.
Know what he wants.
He's got an earpiece?
He's flashing a government badge?
That's not a government
badge.
I'm hearing
badge. Helicopters. I'm hearing black helicopters.
You can't touch that equipment.
We haven't done anything wrong, so I'm sure there's nothing for us to worry. Rockwell, somebody's watching me. Boy, that was kind of weird.
The IRS is definitely watching him.
Right.
All I remember was there was a flashy thing. Did they use a flashy thing?
Oh, a flashy thing?
Just now.
My mind for the past 10 minutes or so is just a complete blank. I have no memory of what happened.
Oh,
that was just weird.
We got some time left on the show, though. Do you want to do a mailbag?
I think we should talk about... a new podcast, but I think we need some theme music to go with it.
Did you just railroad me into announcing my side project?
Let's talk about it, Charlie.
Okay. Library 2020 is a new podcast from the Georgia Tech Library, all about the future of libraries, viewed through the lens of the library renewal. That's kind of like I practiced that, but I didn't. I've just been listening to this song over and over again because this is my theme music. I even did it official. I got it licensed and everything. Not like that television song that we're using without permission for this show.
Somebody's watching us, Charlie, and listening.
I just hope Tom Verlaine isn't the jerk that everyone says he is about, you know, rights and all that. But yeah, I did the first episode, and I released it yesterday. It's out there in the world. You can find it on iTunes, not on Stitcher. But you can also find it at library2020.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN. Hi, Amit.
And we're...
Oh, we're out. Have a great weekend, everybody. Happy Halloween. My mind is blank.
Stop eating that candy, man.
Thanks for listening to Lost in the Stacks from WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library. Find us online at wrek.org/lostinthestacks to see playlists for old shows, connect with our social media, or get in touch with us.